My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential. Welcome to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. Jeff Lerner, your host. Always thrilled to be back with you, having amazing conversations with amazing human beings. Sometimes we get to have another amazing conversation with a familiar human being. And in this case, that is the case with Coop Blackson, who was a guest on Unlock Your Potential episode number 203 and is back now for episode number... I don't actually know what number this is, but it's about 75 episodes ago. But cool. No, it's not often we get to have guests back on the show, but I always love it when it happens because we get to leave off from the last conversation and go deeper. So I will say, if you're wanting the primer on Coot, go back to episode 203 because we're going to pick up and go into the deepest waters we can here. Coot, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate having me back.
No, it's great to have you back. I really enjoyed our first conversation. So I'll tell you what, rather, you know, obviously there's a whole, you know, hour long primer that people have at their disposal if they want to go listen to that other episode. But for those who don't or can't for whatever reason, maybe we could give like the 2 minute refresher on kind of who you are, what you do, and you know, set up where we're going to go from here.
Yeah, look, I'm a nationally bestselling author of 2 books. You Are the One, The Magic of Surrender. I'm a transformational teacher, speaker, create transformational processes. Started out doing one-on-one, deep, intensive work 22 years ago. Became very known for the work of transforming people from the inside out. I call it uncoaching. And we'll create transformational processes for small groups, large groups. And my mission is to help people awaken to who they truly are and expand their consciousness and live love and live their purpose in the world. And I was born in Ghana, West Africa. My father's from Ghana. My mother's Japanese. I grew up in London. I live in the U.S. now and partly Mexico sometimes. And I feel like I'm a citizen of the world. You know, my childhood, in a nutshell, was a bit unusual. It's how I got started, you could see, in this field. It wasn't from reading a book or going to a seminar. My first memories as a young boy was seeing a crippled woman crawling on the floor. She picks up the gravel that this man walks on, wipes it on her face, and stands up. And so week after week, I grew up seeing miracles. Blind people see and deaf people hear. And this man was my father. He built 300 churches in Ghana, West Africa, a huge church in London, hundreds of thousands of people in Ghana at his height, and was considered a miracle man. So I grew up in this spiritual kind of mystical context. And at age 8, I started speaking. Age 14, I was ordained as a minister, given the mandate to take over my father's church. 18, I left everything. And in a nutshell, won a green card in the lottery, came to the US, $800, 2 suitcases, and went and found mentors and teachers in the self-help field at 18 years old and studied with them. And then traveled a bunch and had my own, shall we say, spiritual awakening. And from that point, 20 some years ago, came back to the US again and began working with people before coaching was a thing, before coaching was popular.
So I'm so excited that you're back for a second round here because I feel no pressure to like get through the whole story. Yeah. And we can dig deep into any little particulars. And that's pretty liberating. So I want to start with this idea that, I mean, first of all, sorry, you can see me fidgeting. I'm adjusting my foot mat that I stand on. It gets all crumpled. But anyways, so first of all, I mean, what a way to grow up with a father as a miracle healer. And I actually, if you're okay with it, I'd like to stay in that childhood for a little bit if we can, because I mean that's kind of easy to gloss over, but I think it's a disservice to, like, you grew up watching, in your words, miracles happen on the daily. Like, we're talking, like, I mean, it sounds like some biblical kind of stuff.
Some real shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But tell here's me the thing. The thing is, I didn't think anything of it, you know, and I didn't even think it was a big deal. And people now say, "Ooh, did that shit really happen? You're crazy. You're bro, I grew up seeing it every day. This is before social media, nothing to prove, just My father, every day, a person would come in with crutches and he would say, hey, why do you have these crutches? Well, I haven't walked in 5 years. Do you believe? Do you believe in God? Do you believe in the power inside of you? Do you believe in God's power? Yeah, I believe. So why the hell do you have these crutches? Throw these crutches away. But I can't, and I haven't. And this, there would be like a negotiation for 5 minutes, and then he'll put his hands on the person. He's like, do you believe? Yes, boom. They will start walking. And so I didn't think anything of it, and I didn't know it was a big deal until I went to school and I would start talking about this, and teachers thought I was a bit crazy. And so I think there was a blessing in thinking it was normal, because I grew up with a expanded sense of possibility. Like, shit, everything is available. Everything is possible. Why not? Let's do it. Let's go for it. And so, yeah, I grew up seeing some real stuff every day.
So was it, what was the specific sort of faith lineage? Was it overtly Christian?
So my father started healing people when he was about 15 years old, as a young man. He had a kind of spiritual conversion as a young boy in Ghana, West Africa. He didn't come from a rich background, not very educated, just believed. And then he figured, he started to read the Bible, apparently, and Jesus said, the things I do, you can do these things and more. And so my father, being an innocent kid, said, well, if Jesus said it, then I'm going to try. And he put his hands on people, and people started getting healed. Obviously, he had something in his lineage. My grandfather apparently was a healer, so my father had this something. And people start, as a 15, 16, 17-year-old kid, people started coming from all around Ghana. This sort of blossomed, and he started a church. And so my father started out very, you could say, orthodox Christian. When probably in the 60s and 70s, before I was born, he went to India, apparently, and had some, shall we say, spiritual, mystical experiences that he couldn't explain in caves. So the stuff you read about in books like Autobiography of a Yogi, with a guy called Yogananda, and he started having these spiritual, mystical experiences. And so that expanded his consciousness. So by the time I was born, my father was really a mystic. The thing is, even though he had this kind of, some would call it an enlightenment experience, awakening, he kept his churches, and he delivered, an uplifting message through his churches. And so by the time I was born, my father was a very metaphysical kind of man, a very mystical kind of man, not just old school Christian. And so some might call him a Christian mystic, but he was very evolved in his way of seeing things. And so I grew up with the sense that Jesus wasn't just this person. Jesus wasn't just Jesus the Christ. To me, I grew up with the sense that Christ is an energy and a consciousness that is available to everyone, and we all have the ability through our surrender, through our meditation, through our spiritual practice, to awaken the Christ nature inside of us all. And so my father was a mystic in his own way.
So it's interesting. I feel like we're touching on, and I don't want to attribute unintended meaning to your words. They're your words. So yeah, if I say anything that presumes that you meant something that isn't what you meant, please correct me. But I feel like we're sort of touching on something that I believe is actually a distortion of the modern world, which, as you put it, is, you called it old school Christianity, which is to take Christianity, and I think, frankly, the modern or postmodern world, as it were, frankly, does this to all mainstream, or call it all of like the big religions, where they have turned it into this sort of stodgy, like cloistered, like you put it, old school, you know, big buildings and lots of like external orientation of faith. And you said, no, my father was a Christian mystic, but I'll tell you my own reckoning. And I'll say this of Christ, but I'll frankly say this of all the major religious or faith figure. I don't actually really like the word religion. It comes from the Latin word for bondage, so it's not my term of choice. But all of the modern major faith figures, I perceive that they were much more mystical and spirit and consciousness focused than how the modern world has tried to almost caricaturize them, because it makes it easier to talk about religions in the media. So do you actually think that your father represented a new wave of Christianity, or do you think that he actually represented a return to original Christianity, which was, you know, much more?
I think, I mean, obviously I wasn't around in that time, right? The original time,
but you're a student of these things.
I think my father tapped into the real essence and the real meaning of what Jesus realized in his own realization, the real essence before maybe things were interpreted and distorted by humans. And so I think he tapped into the real essence and the real meaning, you know, and he found a deeper truth as to the real meaning of Jesus's teachings.
Did your father continue to identify as Christian after he had these experiences? I mean, he preached in churches, right?
Yeah, he had his own churches, you know, he preached. But I think also, if I can be honest, he also spoke to a certain context of people that had a certain education, certain understanding, a certain culture, certain framework. So I would say that he spoke in a language that they could understand. Mm. And he spoke in a framework and a language that they could understand, rather than just sort of blowing everything up. And so I think he was very, what's the word? There's a word for very, he built a bridge, right? He built a bridge in a certain way. And I think in many ways in Ghana, in Africa, really helped evolve the understanding of the teachings of Christ in somewhere like a Ghanaian nation. So yeah. So did he identify as Christian? I think he would probably say, well, depends what you mean by Christian, and whose definition of what Christian is. But I think he identified with the Christ and the true Christ consciousness that is, I believe, our true nature for all of us.
So do you still consider yourself to be, or how, on a scale of 1 to 10, let's say, how aligned do you consider yourself to be now after all of your journey with kind of where you started under his, you know, paternal tutelage?
Again, I think the thing is, my father, when I was born, was very spiritual, very mystical, not so much even religious, even though he had these churches. So his real teaching was, you know, about helping people awaken the Christ nature in them. So in that sense, you know, the essence of what I believe and what I experience and what I feel is not that different. You know, it really is. It's not that different. It's a very metaphysical in nature. There were differences in terms of also why I left my father. I was ordained at 14 into my father's ministry, given the mandate to take over my father's organization. Everyone was excited but me, in the sense that it just didn't align. And one of a few reasons that I, you could say, left the church in a traditional, organized sense was, number one, I didn't feel it was my calling, and I had to follow the calling of my soul, the calling of my own inner guidance that was moving me, that was beyond myself. That was one. Number two, there were a few things about how my father went about it, which I understood was for his people, because the people he taught were in Africa, and there were a certain level of education. But I felt that my father, bless his soul, because he started out being a miracle worker, right? A lot of the congregation and the people came for the miracles. They came for the flash. They came for the boom. They came for the, you know, flying across the room. They came for the energy. They came for the Shakti. They came for the high. They came for the miracles. And so, you know, my father, you know, there were things that he did that I just didn't agree with, because I felt as though people were becoming dependent on him and the miracles rather than truly connecting directly with God, the divine nature of their own being, with the true source connection. And I think they were sort of wanting the miracle. Okay, when right. is he going to do the miracle? Or my father would, for instance, say, okay, bring some oil next week and I'll bless it. Boom, church would be full. They wanted the oil, but they didn't want to meditate. They didn't want to learn how to truly pray. They didn't want to learn how to truly connect, you know, to do the sort of real spiritual practice. And so for me, there was some sort of disagreements in methodology that I felt like you can give a man a fish, but well, the old saying, you feed him for a day, but you got to teach him how to fish. And so, and my father had some really deep, profound teachings that he would try to unfold. And maybe he didn't do it as much because the people, you know, his audience didn't want it as much. But I just felt like in the long run, it was making people dependent and putting their power outside of themselves, which I see in many ways, even in modern day spirituality in the scene today. You know, people do as well. They give their power away to some spiritual teacher or some guru figure or plant medicine or just something outside, rather than realizing that the true medicine is inside of you. The true kingdom of heaven, the true source of life is within. And so those, I would say, were some of the differences that I had with my father.
So I feel like you're touching on really the grand metaphor, or maybe the grand fund, you know, I don't want to say the word problem. It's just the grand reality at the core of the human condition. And what I'm striving for in my life and my work is, it feels very aligned, is to unlock everybody. I mean, the reason this show is called Unlock Your Potential is to unlock every single human's, you know, it starts with the simple recognition that, like, I have the power. And then to unlock that and empower them to actually do it for themselves, rather than, to your point, to be dependent on whether it's a church, whether it's some internet guru, whether it's the government or who's president, whether it's their big corporate employer. You know, dependency breeds hostility. That is like one of the fundamental axioms across all of psychology. And it's ironic because we live in a world now where I would say spiritually, financially, professionally, relationally, in terms of just availability of information and in every area of life, certainly physically in terms of health, we are more individually capable than any time in human history. And yet statistically, we've allowed ourselves to become more dependent on large institutions than any time in history, at a time when it's the most unnecessary to be that way. And that's why we see, frankly, we're more unhappy, at least statistically, according to census and general social survey data and whatnot. So for what it's worth, I totally agree with you that, like, I'll tell you one of my favorite quotes. Ayn Rand said that civilization is the process of setting man free from men. Mm-hmm. And that mindset of, like, no, if it is to be, as it's up to me, as opposed to, if I want to have it, I need to align with the right institution or the right party or the right church or the right spiritual healer or whatever. So thank you.
Look, my first book is called You Are the One. and the first sentence of the book is called, literally starts, no one is coming. That's the first, no one is coming to save you.
How do we get that through people's heads? Because they don't want to hear that. You look at the world, especially in an election season. Yeah. Everybody wants to place a bet on someone else to save them. And I agree with you. No one is coming. But how do we get people to listen to that?
I don't know if you can get people to listen. You know, I don't think you can necessarily make people change in that sense. I think what we can do is live life in such a way that your life, my life, that you create, that I create a life that is so fulfilling, aligned, alive, exciting, you know, prosperous. The fruit of life is so amazing that it becomes a demonstration of that. And as a result, people see that embodiment and are inspired by the example, and then in a sense want what you have, want to know how you are experiencing that. And then I think the message can penetrate, can enter. So I don't think you can make people, and I think sometimes on the other side, people have to hit rock bottom or suffer enough to get to the point where they realize, shit, no one is coming, because now I'm here. And so sometimes I wish people more suffering and more pain, because sometimes It's only when you hit the bottom and you've been waiting and Santa Claus doesn't show up, you know, Buddha doesn't show up, your parents don't show up, how many presidents have we had, man? The shit's still the same, you know, with Obama, Trump. I mean, for the most part, a lot of it still the same. So I don't really care who is a president, who is a prime minister. It's like, to me, we have to be willing. There comes a point where you end up living the same over and over again, that you hit a point of pain, frustration, anger, what have you, that you get pissed off enough, upset enough, frustrated enough to say, I have to change. And you've waited long enough to realize really no one's coming. And I think at that point, that might be a point where people go, okay, I am the one that I've been looking for. I am the one that has to turn this around. And it requires the willingness to take responsibility for oneself and one's life and one's growth and one's evolution. It requires the willingness to give up victim consciousness, because it's a lot easier to abdicate responsibility and say, be a victim about things rather than truly shifting. It's a lot easier also to look at Michael Jordan and the sort of super talented people, Bruce Lee, Muhammad Ali, and say, whoa, they're so special. You know, Jeff, you're so special. Because also if I say, well, you're so special, then I don't really have to change because you're special and I'm not, and you're gifted and I'm not, rather than say, you know what? I have to do this. And so that requires giving up victim mentality and victim consciousness to realize you are not a victim. You are a soul that is incarnated into this human experience in order to learn to grow and evolve. And everything you're going through is part of your own soul choice and growth and evolution. And ultimately, either you, in order to grow through it, you have to go through it and learn the lessons and rise above. And so it also requires giving up all sense of entitlement. To me, there's three pillars of life and success talking about this. The first is we have destiny, a sense of destiny, karma, that we're born into. So let's say you are born Bill Gates' son. You know, there's a certain destiny in that, right? He just bought his daughter, who's 27, 28, a $50 million penthouse house in New York. It's a bit different than being born in a slum in Mumbai in India, you know, your parents making $2 a day. So there's a certain destiny that you're born into that is real, that there's certain privileges in that situation. But I would also say, in terms of karma, when you're born into that, there is an energetic karmic momentum that we are all born into based on the sort of unresolved traumas, unresolved energetic, psychological, spiritual, karmic tendencies that have been passed down through our lineage, stuff that our parents did and grandparents did. So that's an energy that we are also born into. And many times we're living the stream, the flow of that unresolved shit that has been passed down, maybe in the form of addiction, maybe in the form of certain patterns that haven't been resolved. So that's destiny. But does that mean because you're born into a favela or a slum, you're screwed and you're stuck and that's it? No, that's where that sense of responsibility has to come into play. So the second pillar, you could say, to life and success becomes your commitment, your willpower, your effort, your focus, your dedication, that willingness to take complete responsibility for one's life. To me, so destiny, karma, one third. Dedication, commitment, responsibility, another third. I look at someone like Novak Djokovic. I don't think he's the most naturally gifted and talented player, tennis player. I look at people like Federer and Nadal, right? But this dude, through his sheer willpower and effort and focus and practice and discipline and intentionality, has willed himself into the number one player in the world, maybe in history. So he had a kind of maybe momentum of energy where his parents were very sporty, but through that responsibility and focus and determination and grit, took his destiny and was able to shift it and turn it around. So I think there's elements that affect our life and our destiny. And I think that willingness to take 100% responsibility is key. Does that mean things are going to go exactly how you want? I don't always think so. Does that mean things will work out in a certain way? Not always, because I think there's a few factors at play. I look at someone like Donald Trump, love him or hate him, okay? I think he's an interesting character. Donald Trump, it's almost like, I'm going to say the dude, I'm going to say he can't lose, but this is a guy who has this kind of magic dust on him, okay? You look at his karmic momentum, born into a very wealthy family. However, I don't think he would have gotten to the level that he has risen to just based on that. There had to be a deep determination, focus, intention that enabled him to maximize his destiny. So I think when the two can go together, your destiny sort of line and your dedication responsibility line, that's when I think you can maximize your potential.
So what do you say to, forgive the term, but let's call it the average person, the person who wasn't born
to wealthy parents
or with great athletic genetics or whatever, right? The person who can point to someone else and say, oh, well, they have what I don't have, and that explains the difference in the results. What do you say to that person? And that person, by the way, is almost everyone.
Like,
there's very few people that are the statistical outliers in terms of natural gifts or external circumstances. So what do you say to that person who you know? And I'll state a precondition for what I'm about to ask. The precondition is, or the postulate, if you will, is that every human on earth, their life would be better if they believed in possibility. And like to your point, they rejected any notion of being a victim or that there's futility in their labor because it's just not in their cards. Like, everybody would be better if they just acted as if they could do whatever they set their mind to, right? So given that that's true, and there's no one on earth that isn't true for, that your life would be better if you acted as if you could achieve whatever you set your mind to, what do you say to that person that is insistent on making excuses and comparisons rather than just saying, well, it doesn't really matter where I end up. The reality is I can only control what I can control. And what I can control is whether or not I act as if anything is possible or not. What do you say to that person? Because most people,
I don't know if I would say to that person, because if they're, I would say, hey, you want to be right? Or you want to be free? You want to be right? Or you want to create life in a different reality? Because if that person is so addicted or attached to fighting for their limitation, you and I are not going to convince them otherwise, you know, because what that requires is that they let go of that idea and identity, which can be incredibly terrifying, because if they let that go, they have no one else to blame. They have no other excuses. So, if someone doesn't want to let that go and they're more committed to holding on to that, really to keep themselves safe, to keep themselves in a safe zone, to protect their ego.
Define what you mean by define what you mean by safe in that context, though, because it's not what you and I mean by safe.
Yeah, by safe, I mean, if I fight for my limitation, then I don't have to risk putting myself out there. I don't have to risk taking the risk. I don't have to risk going into the unknown. I don't have to risk freaking going for it and falling on my face and failing. I don't have to risk doing new things. I don't have to risk being ridiculed. I don't have to risk my family laughing at me. I don't have to risk. I can just do my work, do my jobs, stay average, do my work, even I'm not happy about it, and not really be bold, you know? And I think that's the safe zone, staying in that comfortable zone of the known. Don't have to risk that. Don't have to risk going for my purpose. Don't have to risk the potential disappointment that will come in the pursuit of your dreams, right?
Yeah.
And if I don't really, if I fight for my limitation and I stay average, fight for my averageness, I don't have to really be disappointed. I mean, I'm sure you have, Jeff, but I've been disappointed so many times swinging for my dreams over and over again. I remember when I was in my 20s, early 20s, I wanted to do a TV show. I wanted to be the next Oprah, right? Do a TV show. And I must have tracked down, okay, 200 to 300 people in the industry. And I tracked down Steven Spielberg, David Geffen, you know, Richard Branson. I mean, I tracked these dudes down to pitch them my idea, and most of them rejected me and laughed at me. And it's hard. And so I would tell that person, you want to be right or you want to be free. It's very simple. Because, and then I would say, if you're that committed to your limitation, then go for it. Because nothing you and I can say is going to truly make someone let go if they don't want to. And the thing is, most people, here is the truth that self-help books don't want you to know. These self-help books that want to pander to people and sell you a bunch of soft, fluffy bullshit, say stuff, you can do whatever, you can be whatever. The truth is, most people will not fulfill their potential in this lifetime. Most people will not fulfill their potential in their lifetime because they're holding on to being a victim, because they're holding on to entitlement, because they're not taking responsibility, because they're not willing to go outside of that comfort zone.
Hey there, real quick, I just wanted to let you know, I have been concentrating a lot lately on providing tons of value to my text message community. This could be random thoughts, this could be letting you be the first to know about an event I'm planning or a special I'm running or a free training I'm hosting. Anyway, just shoot me a text to get subscribed. The number is 702-996-3926. Thanks so much. Let's get back to the podcast. So I feel like, the truth is always and when I say the truth, I mean, you know, I always reference this, one of my favorite sort of delineating quote. I don't want to call it a quote. It's the opening chapter of The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck, where he defines sanity. And he says sanity is a dedication to seeing reality as it is, regardless of the price tags.
Okay. That's
so
good.
When I say truth, I actually mean like sanity. Like I
reality.
Like the most sane reality-based interpretation of these concepts to me is that you're right. We cannot do anything. Like the reality is we can't do anything.
But, I'm not gonna be LeBron James.
No, but we have a higher probability of doing what we can do if we go out and act as if we can do anything.
But here's the thing. I would not advise someone to go out and act like they're going to be in the NBA if you're 4'1".
Right.
Just to be clear. And so I think part of the issue is many people are setting goals or trying to navigate having a certain life based on the illusion of who they think they are. So you might achieve... And there's the challenge. We compare ourselves to other people. I go on social media, I see Jeff, I want to be like Jeff. But maybe being like Jeff is not my true authentic nature, is not my true, my unique God-given purpose in this lifetime. So I think that many times we set goals based on who we think we are, but if not, we're not truly in touch with who we are, then our goals and the life that we think we should be going for is a projection of unmet needs from childhood. Didn't feel enough, didn't feel worthy, didn't feel valuable. So if I can just be like Jeff or be like Toot or be like Tony Robbins or be like, you know, Kanye West or be like Donald Trump, then I'm going to be enough. Now we end up chasing a carrot that isn't even really a carrot, rather than truly aligning with our authentic truth our authentic nature so that we can then connect to our soul, our heart, our authenticity, and feel what is it that I'm truly meant to go for. And I think when you get clear on that, what is it that's authentic for me? Then, yeah, do what you say. Go for that as though you couldn't fail. Go for that like you're fully responsible. And then you go for it. Now you're at least in alignment on the right path.
So I mean, first of all, I'm remembering why after every episode, you know, obviously I have a booker and people that go out and find guests, and there's always really interesting new people that we want to bring on the show. So that's why I don't do that many repeat episodes. But I'm totally remembering why after our last episode, I told my guys, I'm like, hey, if we can ever get Coop back on the show, I want to continue that conversation because I not only align with everything you're saying, but like I feel it with that same depth of conviction that you clearly display. And one thing I want to bring up, you know, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's not about being, I could be Jeff, I could be Coot, I could be LeBron, I could be whoever.
I could be Elon Musk. I could be,
look, yeah. If my gifts were Coot's gifts, then I could be Coot. In fact, I could be Coot, but better. Because Coot himself probably isn't the most actualized version of himself either. But my gifts aren't Coot's gifts. My gifts are my gifts. But there is some equivalent, elevated, heroic, archetypal version of myself that is possible based on my gifts. And I'm more likely to achieve that if I act as if I can do anything I set my mind to. But again, I probably, you know, within that, we don't give up discernment. We don't abdicate our reason to what we set our mind to. If I'm 4'1", playing in the NBA isn't the thing I likely should set my mind to. But whatever the thing is, it's the ability to operate as if infinite possibilities are real, knowing that we'll have to settle at some point for some finite result. But the idea is to create both the external conditions and especially the internal conditions that maximize the probability that whatever result we achieve is the greatest possible result for us. Mm-hmm. And that's all I'm saying. So I want, and you nailed it, same as I believe, it really depends on really finding out who we truly are.
Yeah.
And so I want to get...
And what we truly are at the deepest essence is infinite. That like what we, our true nature, the body is finite. The personality is finite. Your feelings are finite. All of the stuff out here in the world is finite. We live in a three-dimensional realm, world of duality. Yin, yang, up, down, black, white, positive, negative, you know, impermanent, time, space. In this 3D, it is a realm of duality and limitation. If you jump off a building, you know, most of us, we're not going to fly. So there are limitations out here. You know, most of us, we need to eat. We're not going to just live on breath for the next 50 years. So there are limitations to this physical body. Like, you're going to die, bro. Everyone. I mean, I know there's people that they've asked me, well, want to be immortal. You're going to die. This physical body will die. Your consciousness, the true essence of what you are, which is the invisible energetic frequency vibration that is your beingness, that is transcendental, is beyond birth, is beyond death. It doesn't die. This body is just a costume that falls off, and that continuum of energy will continue through eternity because it's one with source and life. And so life, this 3D, is finite. And so I feel as though you could say if life is a game, we as infinite consciousness incarnate into this limitation, into the realm of limitation, to become masters of limitation, not to be limited by this limitation, but to, in the game that is life, to find, to awaken, to remember the infinite nature of our true essence inside of limitation. That's when I think we can be free in the world, but not of the world. So that's why I think someone like Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. I didn't say it. Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. He didn't say, the kingdom of heaven is in your Lamborghini. Now, I happen to like Lamborghinis, but the kingdom of heaven is in your mansion. The kingdom of heaven is in your helicopter. The kingdom of heaven is within you. And seek ye first the kingdom of God all these things will be added onto you.
So let me ask sort of a semantic clarification. How do you, what is the relationship between the kingdom of God that is within me and my true essence of self, my eternal, non-limited, energetic essence that is within me? Are those two ways of saying the same thing?
Yeah, I think when you find the kingdom of God, you realize that you are not separate from that. You are not separate from that. You are.
And that's
that.
Is that the they talk about the duality of consciousness. Is that the duality that we are simultaneously the entire kingdom of God realized through spirit on earth, while at the same time being one of literally hundreds of billions of fractal incarnations of that? So we're simultaneously unique and the same in that sense.
Yes. Yes. That's a nice way to put it.
So one thing I want to share with you that I feel like may spark a line here. I'm sure you're well familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs and this notion
bit, yeah.
that it's a psychology framework and the audience knows it. It basically says like, but I was recently exposed to some information based on unpublished papers of Maslow, and Maslow was part of a movement called humanistic psychology. So there's a number of psychologists that have essentially, and this is what I think the modern world does to based on the abundance of information out there, we try to compartmentalize everybody into these little digestible concepts. But so the typical presentation of Maslow is like a cascade of priorities that we first we prioritize our physiological needs, and then as long as those are tended to, then we get to our safety needs, and then as long as those are tended to, then we get to love, and then we get to esteem, and then we get to self-actualization. And so I think that the way Maslow is presented, whether people explicitly refer to Maslow or they just sort of experience it as part of the zeitgeist of their you know world, is that like, well, self-actualization or becoming my true self or you know, all of this metaphysical woo-woo stuff, that's all a luxury for people who can afford it, people who don't have the same stresses that I do, people that, you know, aren't working three jobs just to make ends meet as a single mom. And I don't mean to be irreverent about that reality for people, but Maslow is presented as this sequential cascade that, frankly, most people in the world, because of the practical realities of living, they never even get to self-actualization. But the more you study Maslow, or if you actually go read his papers, you find out he wasn't saying that you have to achieve safety to unlock love. And that you have to achieve love to unlock esteem. He was saying that humans are striving for all five of these at the same time, all the time. And so I'm curious, you know, if and how you take on in your work people's tendency to try to push what I think you and I believe are the most important questions of life. They try to push them off to say, okay, well, I'll get to all that highfalutin, you know, soul and spirit stuff once I resolve how I'm going to pay my rent this month. And I actually think there's an inversion, there's a fallacy there where getting more clear on who you are increases the probability that month after month after month after month, you won't have to worry about paying your rent because you'll be more in alignment with your gifts. But how do you take that on in people's sort of practical biases?
Yeah, look, I mean, the truth is I have compassion. If someone is, you know, I go to Africa, and if someone is starving, they need food. I mean, it's real. You know, if someone is starving, the likelihood of them wanting to sit and meditate is going to be a bit less. That's for sure, right? If someone is, I got to pay my rent, then yeah, I think they're going to be much more stressed and less likely to be pursuing or spending massive amount of time in their own internal spiritual practice. And so I think there is a level of reality, because we do live in a 3D world, you know. And I'm in agreement with you in that I think the more we are able to tap into our true essence on that spiritual level, the more we access dimensions of ourself and our creativity and our intelligence that is beyond the human, logical, limited, linear ego mind, the more we will be receptive to ideas and possibilities and creative, you know, inspiration that will move us into the next level of abundance and work and creation and ideas and maybe entrepreneurship that will open up more. And so I think, I don't think there's a right way to do it. I think everybody has their own path. You know, I think everyone, I've met some of the richest people in the world who are not interested in self-actualization. And I've met some of the poorest people in the world who are all about self-actualization. And that was their focus. So I really ultimately feel...
Who did you observe to seem happier? The richest person in the world that doesn't, or the poorest person in the world that does? Focus on these considerations.
Honestly, the poorest person. And I haven't met every rich person, but some of the poorest people I met in the slums of India, as just one example, were so peaceful and were so kind and were so, they were so at peace with their reality and existence. And I remember they just welcomed me into their tiny little, you know, I don't know if it's 100-square-foot house with 8 people living in it. And they were at peace. This was their life. This was their reality. And they were grateful. And so I think it was beautiful to experience. So I think everyone has their own path and everyone has their own journey in this life. And I don't think there's like one right way to pursue it. I think ultimately for all of us, it's kind of like we're all part of the same river and we're all part of the one river and we're flowing in the same direction and we will all get to the same destination, however we go and however we get there. You know, I think we're all in the process of evolution and we are all in the process of self-actualization. Ultimately, it's our destiny. It's where it's going to flow. Maybe for some, it takes a lifetime. Maybe if there is such a thing, maybe for some it takes 700 lifetimes. But it's kind of like we're all moving there.
Do you have a synthesized, consistent answer to the question of what is the purpose of not just life, but like at a conceptual level, this whole life experiment? Like, why was infinite consciousness placed inside of these meat suits that expire, and what is it that we're supposed to do during that window of time? Do you have a notion of the purpose of life?
Well, I don't mean I don't know, man. You know, I mean, I can spew off some stuff, which I will, but I ultimately don't know. You know, maybe there's no real purpose. Maybe this moment is the purpose. Just being here now is just the purpose. More and more I feel the purpose of life is this moment. The purpose of life is every moment to moment, right? And so I think that I would say that infinite consciousness manifesting as a multiplicity of form, as all form, as a, we could call it an experiment, as a play of consciousness to experience itself in all flavors, in its unlimited nature. And, you know, to be in unlimited nature, to me, unlimited is the light and the dark. It's all of it. It's Mother Teresa, and it's Hitler, and it's the apartheid guys, it's Mandela. It's unlimited nature. And so infinite consciousness expressing itself as a multiplicity of form in order to experience all aspects of itself in the plate that is life, you know? And so for me, this whole experiment, you could say, and this whole experience is like a one-man show, which one woman, one being, one person, one-man show, where there's really only one that is living the all. It appears like there's me and there's you and we're separate. But I think that two things, either when we die and we wake up out of this costume that is Jeff or Coot, we will awaken to the reality that shit, that there was only, we take the veil off, the Jeff mask off and the Coob mask off, we'll realize, oh shit, hey, there's only one of us here. We were being played by the one actor, the divine actor that is life. Or you could say maybe part of that game is the process of awakening. And you could say that maybe part of enlightenment, even though at the deepest level we're all already enlightened, but part of that process of enlightenment is in the play that is life, this illusory play that is life, to wake up to and beyond the illusion of separation, so that we can realize the oneness of it all, you know. And I think that's part of the process, baby. And I think certain enlightened beings, Jesus, Buddha, right, Ramana Maharishi, the list goes on, have awoken to that realization.
Yeah,
that's part of the play.
I made this post the other day on Instagram. I said the number one thing that stands out to me the more I study the life of Jesus is that he seems to be the first human in history who insisted adamantly that all humanity is just one tribe. And at the time he lived, I mean, that's all anybody talked about was tribes. Well, what tribe are you in? Well, I'm in this tribe over here, so I'm not. We don't like you guys. And Jesus, that was his radical notion. Basically, was no, there's just one tribe, and we all, it's all derived from the same source. And I think it's interesting. I feel like I don't want to impute meaning to your words, but I feel like in a lot of ways, what it sounded like what you were saying is that at least some of the purpose of life may be to actually wake up to that reality.
I think that's part of the game, you know.
Guys like you and guys like me, we don't look the same. Like in conventional parlance, people would naturally group us in different tribes.
On the surface, like you're wearing a blue T-shirt. I'm wearing a grayish black T-shirt. But this is not who we are. We've just gotten so brainwashed and hypnotized and seduced and conditioned by media and church and religion and advertising and corporations to believe that we are this limited ego structure, this limited ego body structure. Because the more we believe we are this limited little mind, body, meat sack mechanism, and the more I identify with this, the more you identify with that as you, the more we can be manipulated and controlled, and the more we can be sort of divided and pawned off and puppeted and manipulated in terms of being sold a bunch of shit that we don't really need. Because, well, if you're just this body and, oh, you're getting old, you're getting wrinkles, oh, buy this thing, buy this, that, do this thing, then you're going to finally be enough. Or it's easy to divide and conquer humanity when we believe we're separate, right?
Yes.
But if all the presidents came and said, oh, well, you are all one, I mean, why would we be fighting against ourselves if we really knew that we were one? And so much of the suffering of humanity comes from the illusion that we are separate, when in truth, we're one. Trump and Biden, same consciousness, you know, being played. And I think when the curtain goes down and the show goes out and you take the mask off, it's like, wow, I played well.
Yeah. Well, Coot, we're out of time, man. I hate to say it. Speaking of finite and limited, this conversation has run its course. Please share with the world, though. Anybody that's listened to this episode, I have no doubt, is fired up to go get more of your greatness in their life. Where would you send them?
Yeah, a couple of ways. I would say you can check out the book, The Magic of Surrender, that I wrote. It goes into some beautiful concepts. You can find it on Amazon, The Magic of Surrender, the paperback version. I'm going to be announcing a lot of new events in the spring of 2024. So you can go to CootBlackson.com, go to the schedule tab, and find out about some of the events I have coming up. I work with a lot of business leaders, entrepreneurs, visionaries through my mentoring and coaching program. So if you want to find out more about that and working with me, you can go to kublaxon.com/coaching and find out more there. Instagram, kublaxon. Facebook, kublaxon.
Wonderful. Well, Coot, I sure appreciate your time. It's been wonderful having you back on the show.
Thank you.
I say, at some point, I'm hopeful for a round three. I feel like now after two rounds, we peel back another layer or two every time we talk. We do this long enough, we're going to get to truth with a capital T, man.
Wow.
Well, hey, thanks again for being a guest on the show. And to all you viewers and listeners out there, you are the best part of the show, as I tell you every time, and I'm so glad we got this time together. Till next time.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening, especially if you like or share or leave a review. Thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.